half Scandinavian, half German. So maybe some of the stuff I'll go through will sound familiar.
Where did your father come from?
My father's father came from Gudbrandsdalen in a town called Lesja, and it's a farm country, but it's kind of not like the farms we think of here.
I've gone through it.
Yeah, real hilly, and then my mother's side came from the Song Fjord near Bergen, so that was kind of real, not the best land for farming and stuff, so I guess that's why everyone came to the United States. Not the best economics there. But anyway, I'll just go through this. I started writing my family history about 6 years ago. And I did a lot of research, and then I finally sat down and wrote it. And then I got it Xeroxed and put it into a book form. So maybe this will help you out. It wasn't the easiest task I've ever done because there's so much information. Yeah. And to put that all in one book and to kind of make it interesting, because I had seen many genealogies that people kind of just let gather dust, you know. They didn't look at them because there are a lot of dates, a lot of names, but people, you know, didn't find anything to interest them because they didn't know what was going on. So what I wanted to do was make this interesting so that the grandkids or whatever could look at this and say, okay, this is what they were like back then. And so basically I did a lot of research in the library, a lot of research talking, interviewing people, and then I did a good amount of search, what I call field work, actually going to, well, in my case, it was Minnesota and North Dakota, and finding out where my grandparents had settled when they came to the United States. And then, of course, Norway, a little bit, not so much, though. But so those were basically how I got my information. And then writing it down, well, that's probably what I'm going to talk about most, because that's hard.
Where in Minnesota and Norway?
They settled. Seemed like most parts of the family came to Goodhue County and Red Wing area. And the earliest ones went to Wisconsin. But the later ones, I guess my family kind of was midway of the big immigration. They were sort of not the earliest, but then they weren't the latest either. They were kind of right after the Civil War. So they settled in Goodhue County, and then they slowly started moving across the West and finally ended up in Bellingham, Washington. And then it turned out there were a lot of people that were similar, and that's how my mother and father met. So anyway, so I was back there, say, about 6 years ago and doing a lot of research there. And then they went to Minot, North Dakota, that area. So it was, I call it like a slinky. They kept kind of moving across the country. And it seemed like in my case, it was either the parents went or the children went. But then if the children went, then the parents were soon to follow. Or in one case, it was the parents went and then the children would follow. But that's usually how it worked out. So a little bit at a time. But anyway, I've been working on this family history so long that I have discovered there are quite a few family histories out there that have become very, very good sellers, best sellers. And so I don't think it's impossible. I don't think, if you really do a good job at your family history, I think a lot of people could be interested in it. And so I just brought these. There's this one. It's about woman in the South, and she calls it Mama Makes Up Her Mind. And then this one is a very recent publication called Hole in the Sky, a memoir by William Kitteridge. And he grew up in Eastern Oregon, and he one of the early pioneers out there. And it's well written, and I think there's a lot like that out there, and I think people are are hopefully getting more and more interested in their roots. And I think that will get more and more popular, seems to me. So anyway, what I've dug up here is some quotations. People say, why do you want to work on this project? You know, that's the past. Why don't we just let that go? Or, you know, and people especially would ask me that. They'd say, why are you interested in that? You know, usually people get interested when they're older, or, you know, and I think you can get interested at any age. And I just simply got interested in it because I saw that there was all this information that no one was going to write down. And so I thought, well, I better do it, you know. My mother is great at telling stories, but she never writes anything down. So I realized that no one else was doing it, I better do it.
She's still living?
Yeah, she is, and she's still telling her stories. But she's a great storyteller.
And you're not recording it?
And no, I don't record it. I don't work with a recorder very much. I write things down. I have a really good memory, and particularly if I do it right at while it's going on. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Take a chair or two on here, if you don't mind.
No, we have plenty.
We have plenty.
So anyway, I'm just going to read a few of these quotations that are why people write their family histories. And this one is from this guy, William Kitteridge. He said, without stories, in some sense, we do not know who we are or who we might become. That's current. Then I go back to Rome in 106 BC. The Roman statesman Cicero said, what is human life worth unless it is incorporated into the lives of one's ancestors and set in a historical context? And I like that one particularly because I think everybody is a part of history, and there's a lot going on. In this country, I think a lot of people think the individual, it doesn't matter where you start, you write your own script. And I've never quite believed that. I think we, because of our parents and our grandparents, we are particular people. We're not just anyone. I like that one because we are incorporated in a living stream. So I really like that one. And then Russell Baker, who wrote Growing Up, which has become sort of a bestseller, he started writing his family history because his mother became ill. And I think what happened is she sort of lost speech or something. And he didn't know, he felt so upset, he really didn't know what to do. But he said, gradually it seemed to me the way to deal with it, her illness, was to write about the times the two of us had passed through together. And so he, hello.
Hi.
Family history?
Yeah.
Just in time.
Just in time?
We haven't gotten too far.
Oh, good.
So I better get introduced again. Your name is?
Howard Olberg.
Howard.
Mark Kremen.
And Mark, and I'm Margie.
Margie?
Margie, right. Okay, and we're just going through why somebody would be interested in writing a family history. Oh, next time.
Next time, yes.
Okay, so why somebody would be interested in going through the past and dredging up old relatives that are not even here anymore and stuff like that. So. I was just reading a few quotations by other people who had written their family histories and why they're doing it. And I guess I'll read them again if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
This is by William Kitteridge, who wrote a story, or his history, and he grew up in Southern Oregon. He said, without stories, in some sense, we do not know who we are or who we might become. And then going back over 2,000 years ago, the Roman statesman Cicero said, what is human life worth unless it is incorporated into the lives of one's ancestors and set in a historical context? And then Russell Baker, who just wrote about his mother and his growing up years. His mother had gotten a stroke and was not able to talk anymore, and he was very upset. And so he said, gradually it seemed to me the way to deal with it was to write about the times the two of us spent together. And I think that's a really nice one, too. He looked back and I don't know if she was still able to communicate or not. And then this is Wallace Steigner, who wrote a book about growing up in Idaho and his parents and their relationship. And he says, now I can't avoid it any longer. I have to put words in their mouths. Not very personal words at first. Questions, answers, probes, time fillers. So I guess that's how he got started, with questions. And I think that's probably how anyone gets started on a family history, is saying, you know, who are these people? And at least that's how I got started. I kept hearing names, you know, over and over again. And I thought, you know, why can't I remember that name unless I associate what they did, who they were? It has to be more than just a name. And then this is a man, Edward Dahlberg. He wrote about his life and his mother, who was less than perfect. She was not
putting it in there.
Yeah, right. She was less than perfect, but the way he wrote about her, you know, you just think you have to love her. She just, you know, a character. And so he writes, it's a great pain to divulge the life of a mother, and wicked to betray her faults. Why then do I do it? I have nothing better to do with my life than to write a book, and perhaps nothing worse. Besides, it is a delusion to believe that one has a choice. If this book is a great defect, then let it be. For I've come to that time in my life when it is absolutely important to compose a good memoir, although it is also a negligible thing if I should fail. Fame, when not purchased, is an epitaph which the rains and the birds peck until the letters on the headstone are illegible. And thought that was a little hard to understand, but anyway, he's quite a poet, this guy. Now, this one is Per Strømme, who is a Norwegian writer, if you've ever heard of him. He wrote a book called How Halvor Became a Minister, essentially autobiographical. And later he wrote his autobiography, and he was a very humble Norwegian, right? So this is what he wrote. He said, this is not intended to be an autobiography. Only those people who can look back on an honorable and very productive life, or one who has acquired wisdom, can write or should write autobiographies. I am not such a person. A memory of my life would be, in fact, a summation of many failures, wonderful opportunities that were neglected, and a few efforts that did not work out. When I write memoirs, it is because I can tell about other people. People who actually achieved and who played important roles among us Norwegians. So he didn't think much of his own life, but he thought a lot about the other people that were with him. And it turned out that he was, in fact, a very interesting person. He's just, I don't know, I think he's just humble. And then finally, there's this one I thought was good, because it mentions the future, which is important. People without memories settle for things the way they are. People in active touch with their memories, let me start again. People without memories settle for things the way they are. People in active touch with their memories become restless and filled with energy, prepared in a variety of ways to live beyond definitions and boundaries. Memory would not only permit us, but would insist on a very different present and on a future not domesticated. So that's for those that say, oh, why do you want to get into the past? There's a very good reason. It's because I think it helps us to look forward too. And kind of gives you a situation where you know who you are and where you're going and what's come before you. So have you started becoming interested in family history, or is it just something you think you might?
Ended up, most of our history has been always oral history. Mm-hmm. So as Native American background, although oral history continues, is that none of us had taken time to have it recorded and have it on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, is I have about maybe 150 years of history of,
wow.
from my great grandmother to now.
Mm-hmm.
Of oral history of what my oldest sister is able to dig up right now. History of our one tribal background on my mother's side.
Mm-hmm.
My father's side, I probably could go back further,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't really taken time to look back into the history of my mm-hmm. father's side. The Yakima tribe, Yakima Nation,
yeah,
is one that's large and a lot of resources. And, was a large family on my father's side background.
Mm-hmm.
It would be easier to go back into his history.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to go back into my mother's history
mm-hmm.
because it's our tribal background,
mm-hmm.
where I'm from. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
I want to find more about that.
Yeah, well, I wrote my family history, and it turned out to be in a book like this. And I think that's, you know, the main thing is to get it down, is because when you think about the future, and a lot of things are being lost, and it's so important. And so that's kind of why I got started. And I just realized, you know, my mother had told stories over and over again, and no one was writing them down. It was, so I realized no one, you know, somebody had to do it, so I just did it. And I don't know if I did a good job or a bad job, but, you know, I felt like if I can just tell the story of these people, then it may not be lost. And people, like, that's why I have read those quotes, is because a lot of people are just, you know, they think, why bother? And I think it's real, real, real important. Like Shakespeare, he wrote about, you know, for instance, in the play King Lear, he wrote about a father and his daughters, and they have this conflict, and there you have a family history. I mean, it's, you may not know details like that about your own family, but definitely the family is in literature. And there's a play, Death of the Salesman. It's about a father and his sons, and there you have another family thing going on. And from the Native American tradition, you have quite a few writers now that are really doing well, like Craig Leslie, who's written a book, Winter Kill, about his family and trying to get in touch with his, I think it was his father and his grandfather, and going out in the wilderness and, you know, learning some of the old stories. So if you go through literature, that's one way to kind of figure out what you want to do with what you're doing, and poetry too is the same thing. While we're on that subject, there's a long history of family genealogies and stuff like that. And in fact, right here in the Bible, this is the biggest genealogy book you'll ever read. I mean, you just open this and immediately, you know, you hear about a family.
And you get hear, bored.
You get bored.
Going through Genesis, there are all of the Gads. You think that's interesting?
Well, then you have Adam, and then here, and then after Adam, you have Seth, who lived 800 years. Of course, you know, we probably don't have grandparents who live that long, but...
Not lately.
Yeah.
We had an ancestor that lived 116 years.
You did?
Yeah.
Wow. That's just some kind of record.
For a woman that's 101 right now, she's still in her own home.
Isn't that amazing?
She's been in her own home, the last home, or the home she's in now, she's been in there for just over 60-some years now.
Mm-hmm.
That's her, like, second or third home. And
yeah, that's good.
I belong to the Baldur Samban,
uh-huh.
which is descendants of people that come from the Baldur's area in
uh-huh.
Norway. And I attended the meeting, annual meeting in Minnesota. A few years ago, And I met the genealogist of the Walter Sampa. And she encouraged me to write to her about any problems that I had, and I did. And I had some questions. She wrote back a 2-page letter, enclosed a 16-generation chart, and another chart that went back 40 generations, which showed that I am a descendant of the first king of Norway, Harald Fairhair, and King Olaf, and St. Olaf, you know, and one other king of all Norway, what was his name, something the good. Anyhow, she noted that one of those ancestors had lived to be 116 years.
Wow, 116, huh? Well, seems like be really boy. Well, anyway, so then Seth had Enosh, and then Enosh became the father of Kenan, and he only lived 900 years, and Kenan, and anyway, so on. And but the basic genealogy is like Adam and Eve, and then the next one was probably Cain and Abel, everyone knows about, and then maybe Noah, and then so on. But it's all real family, you know, oriented, and it's sort of the feeling you get is that everyone, there was a lineage, one, you know, sons of Adam or something. And what happened to all the other ones that went, you know, off in different directions? That anyway, so the Bible is really the number one family narrative. And then you get up into the New Testament and you have Jesus and his, let's see, what was it? There was some family, the prodigal son, and so all through it, you get this sense that things are happening in families. That was sort of your orientation, and that's real different than some of the things that are going on today are not like that anymore. You get the sense like everyone is in a corporation, and that's sort of your family, and or you know, so it's. Life has changed, but I do think that this idea has certainly been around for a long time, and I think it will continue, that the family will be where we get our stories and our values and who we are. Anyway, then after the Bible, then there were other works, like the work of Mark Twain, which is the work of the Westward Movement and stuff, and then we get some immigrant classics, such as Roald Dahl, who wrote about the Norwegians and the Midwest, and different ones about the Irish. And then it wasn't until, I think, 1960s or something, we got a book called Roots by Alex Haley. You heard? And he writes about a black family starting back in slave days and going through about, I think, 7 generations, a long time. And it's all mostly oral history. Too. So there's a lot in there, and the book took off. It was just incredibly popular, as you know, and it just shows what you can do with just oral histories, and the way he told it was almost like the Bible too. Very, very good, whatever rhythm or something. But anyway, that got people started thinking, hey, you know, we can do that. We can. We can go out and interview people and then put something together. So it got family history more popular, so you felt like you could do it. So basically, those are the different backgrounds on it. But the reason I wanted to do this class is, as I mentioned at first, is that how to make these histories interesting, how to get away from just saying, okay, and my grandfather was born in 1866, and he came to the United States, and blah, 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 blah. And then also, how to keep things as truthful as you can, because It's amazing how much you can hear one story from someone and hear another story from someone else, and then you wonder, uh-oh, who's right here? An example of that is that when I went and tried to find out about my great-great-great-grandmother, went to Minnesota and looked on her gravestone, and it had the wrong year of her death on it. So I go, uh-oh, what's going wrong here? And so in that case, I found an obituary in the newspaper, and so I realized that occasionally people may put up a grave marker afterwards and get the dates wrong. So the newspaper had to be correct. But anyway, so to keep things correct and interesting, you know, how do you do that? So in order to do that, you have to look at writing, because what you're really doing is writing. And writing is something that I think almost everyone can do and do well, but a lot of people just don't. You know, it's hard to get that pen moving, and, you know, a lot of people say, oh, no, this doesn't sound good, and this happens so much. So people will write, and they'll say, oh, no, this doesn't sound good. Or they'll write something, and they'll just leave it at that. And but you can use your imagination and get things going and change it to make it your own. So that's kind of what the rest of my thing was going to be on, is how to make things interesting. So, any questions so far, or what direction do you want to go in on your particular writing?
You haven't dwelt on your book. You haven't dwelt too much on the charting of the generations.
Okay, you mean like a genealogical chart?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one thing I don't have. Somebody pointed that out. They said, why don't you have a chart? And I don't have a chart. I do have a chronology, though. So I have some dates. Like at the end, I have the dates, the major dates that when people did things. So that's your starting point.
Yeah, my starting point is the charts, who the people were, and when did they live.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I'm hoping to get stories out about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I only have some.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to have a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what about you, Mark? Have you written anything?
I would be more interested in knowing, not like dates and times either, more or less, except for events going on during the different ages ago, more or less like our oral history has been, that things, events that have gone on as, like, more or less before European kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
type of ideas, and sort
mm-hmm.
of, more or less the time. Himself,
mm-hmm.
Who, like, who began who, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Our history of mostly Western Washington tribes have been, I think, as I understand it, more or less been one larger tribe,
mm-hmm.
and then we broke off into other tribes,
mm-hmm.
because of the abundance of the Western Washington.
Uh-huh.
Sound area,
so were you part of the Salish, that the
Coast of
Salish? Uh-huh. Yeah. And then these breakoffs then were not necessarily something that was sort of imposed on you, or was this
sort of more or less from what I understand, like early 1600s, 1700s and on, that as time grew on and population grew on, and smaller clans, and maybe what some of those reasons were, I wanted to dwell in it, and see, you know, sort of like, go into what tribalism was like,
uh-huh.
in our, before the 1700s, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Before people came from the East Coast.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you have a lot of, both of you, really good things to say. And it's just a matter of finding
Who to ask and who to talk to.
How to say it and to get the information that you want. And you have to look at it like, this is your project. So you're in it, whether you want to be or not. You're in the history, you're the focal point. And so you have to work from there and say, choose what you want to say. And it sounds like both of you want to tell stories, narratives. And that's the most interesting, I think, thing about family history is the stories. Because it's just natural, since, you know, people are children, they want to hear a story, and that can be the most interesting. Then the facts and dates, I think those are very, very important too. If you have them, if you don't, you know, if you have them, it can help people get organized where this took place. And if not the date, like you were mentioning, events that were going on at the time. And so I just wanted to get that straight. Now, in my work, I seem to have been sort of, everything I did was because of what I had, what material I had. And I think that's another thing. You can't find out everything, but you're sort of limited to what you can find out. And then that leads to another problem. If you can only find out limited amounts of stuff, you can't really create a character like we do in novels and stuff. How can you make this person come alive? If all you know is that they were born and then they did a certain thing and then they died, it's not, how can you round that out? But if you have oral histories or letters or something to personalize it, that's very, very helpful. Just so you know the good and the bad, which, as I was going to say, one of the mistakes people make in any family history is they leave out the bad. Nobody wants to... and I can understand it if people are living. You know, you don't want to say bad things about people who are living, and I wouldn't either. But in order to make the person realistic, you've got to make them human. And everybody has their weaknesses, and everybody has their strengths. So in order to make the what you write more interesting, you have to tell the whole story. And so I think that's one of the points. But where I finally ended up in trying to figure out how to write this thing is I decided I would write it in three different styles, the whole book. And the first thing is stories. Those were natural. They just fell right into place. Wherever person had a story in their life, I just put it in there and it worked out great. The second part of my writing was what I call exposition, and that's the kind of writing you do in school. It's like, write a 3-paragraph paper on, you know, the history of Holden Village. And so you write down, now, Holden Village was started back here as a mine, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's the exposition. And so in cases where I didn't know too much about my ancestor, I knew, for instance, that there was a civil war going on or something. And so I knew that since they were here, they would have to be doing something at that time. So I would be able to look in history books and find out about that. And then the third part of my writing is what I call journalistic writing. It's like, pretend you're doing a newspaper article, and so you go somewhere like Holden Village, and you say, here I am at Holden Village, and there are all kinds of people here, and, you know, just on-the-spot type of research. And how do you do that in family history? Because that's in the past. How can you be on the spot when it happened 200 years ago? Well, because a lot of the things that are really, really important in the family have to do with a place, a certain place. And we were talking about that earlier. The Norwegians came to the Minnesota. That was a place that meant something to them. And of course, in your culture, the place is so important. For instance, where Where did you grow up? In the Olympia area, you were saying?
Puget Sound,
right. So that has all these memories and all these things, and you can say, this happened here, and, you know, somebody in the family was here, and, you know. And so the place is a real big part of your past. And even if you didn't live there, you can go there and see what it was like to live there. So that's, and you've been to Norway and stuff, so.
And both of my grandparents homesteaded in South Dakota in one county, Lincoln County,
mm-hmm.
in two different townships.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that county published a history book.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has a little bit about almost all the families.
Mm-hmm.
In those old days. And he even had some articles about his uncle by marriage that was published in there. So
mm-hmm.
those all just left out.
Yeah, so you've got it made.
That's part of it.
Uh-huh.
That's a house.
Uh-huh.
And relating family history to history in general.
Uh-huh.
I've been thinking about that quite a bit too, and I went at the bookstore. I bought two of these long fold-out charts. Have you seen those?
No.
The history of the world.
Uh-uh.
And the history of inventions. It's really.
Oh, yeah.
It's really amazing. It,
uh-huh.
It's about a 15-page. You pull it clear out on a wall chart.
Uh-huh.
It stretches out over that whole period.
Uh-huh.
So I hope to relate my family's history.
Mm-hmm.
In those four history books, really,
mm-hmm.
Two of those important points in history and in inventions, science
mm-hmm.
and invention, also, so that you can see the period of time in which they lived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that's a great idea.
Incidentally, the I'm planning to get into computer work there, in which there are genealogy programs.
Mm-hmm.
That have already developed history to relate to your family history.
Mm-hmm.
It's already there for you.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's
and,
something that I didn't have. That
yeah.
sounds like a great
and,
thing.
There are a whole lot of genealogy computer programs available.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of them that they call the Cadillac of genealogy programs is the Roots 3, which has now been developed further into Roots 4. And
wow.
this program is such that as you type in each name,
mm-hmm.
it's automatically set up for your future index in your history book.
Wow.
Alphabetically.
Uh-huh.
Also, as you type in each name and fit it, which will fit into a certain genealogy chart.
Mm-hmm.
You can make any notes you want to about that person
mm-hmm.
at that point that you're putting the name in.
Mm-hmm.
Now that is something that the others don't have.
Well, that sounds like
yeah.
a lot of help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this is going to cost some money, both for the computer, which I haven't bought yet. I've been looking into it for years.
Mm-hmm.
And the genealogy program.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to cost money. But if I get that by then, I think I can continue. And the other thing is getting your down in writing.
Mm-hmm.
I overcome part of that by joining a creative writing class.
Mm-hmm.
So in the process, we were expected to bring some story to
mm-hmm.
each class and tell it.
Mm-hmm.
So I managed to get some things written down that way.
Yeah, it seems like we all need motivation.
Yeah, motivation is part of it.
Yeah. So have you started writing?
I have, just in my mind I have been listening to both my sister and my mother and my, that tells about my great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And my great-grandmother is the one that kept the oral history of one of the Skokomish tribes.
Skokomish?
Yeah. So, we have a person that's 97 years old that has a history of our tribe, and
oh.
he's one that I'm hoping to use my resource person.
Mm-hmm.
knowing about the history of the tribe so far.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully go back and go through some of the other elders of Western Washington.
Mm-hmm.
There's one person, Joe is 97, and Grandma Laura is 99.
Wow.
And there's a person up in British Columbia that's just over 107, I think. He was 107 last year. And he has the history of the whole Salish area of Western states, or, you know, southern British Columbia, Washington State, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Has history of the Salish people.
Mm-hmm.
He's one that knows our language, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, your great grandmother, is she still living?
No.
No.
But I was with her when I was just a baby. I remember knowing of her when we learned basketry through our mother and our great grandmother. Ended up basketry was the trade of our family, our tribe. I learned basketry through my mother how to make baskets. I hope to hopefully intertwine that as part of my history of telling about basketry and the history of basket making.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like a theme almost, because
you weave it in kind of thing.
Well, and what you're weaving is memories, but you're also weaving a basket.
Yeah, and you like a flat wood.
Well, that's great. Yeah. There was a woman that wrote a book called The Rag Rug, and how she got started was her grandmother or something had started making a rag rug with pictures, and this was telling about how she came from Norway, came to this country, and then unfortunately she died before she could finish it, so she gave it to her granddaughter and said, "Will you finish this?" And of course her granddaughter wasn't good at weaving, so then she wrote a book. She said, "I'm sorry, grandmother, I can't finish your rag rug, but I am writing this book, and this is my rag rug, the book." So it was great.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, and it's a very good book because it goes through five generations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you could go back much
further,
but with your basket weaving, it's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Use that in probably.
An
introduction kind of thing.
In the whole thing, I think
whole thing,
one of the things is to make it simple, because it can be exceedingly complex, but if you make it simple, it's so much easier to understand. Just, everybody seems to have some outstanding trait, and if you can focus on that one thing, then people can really understand it better. So, sounds interesting. Yeah, we gotta get you writing.
Yeah.
So I have this paper here. See if we have time. I was gonna 15 minutes of writing at the end of this little exercise. But let me see if I can finish up what I'm saying here. I'm gonna give you an example of each kind of writing from my book. But let's see. First of all, I mentioned place, and I'm going to read just a little bit about my visit to Red Wing, Minnesota. Red Wing surprised me in many ways. Its location on the Mississippi River, so far north, was unexpected, as was the river's wide girth so close to its incipience. The town itself appeared amazingly eastern in appearance. Unlike the slapped-up storefronts and rambling streets that came to characterize the West, Red Wing is made up of several storied red brick buildings in compact blocks. I learned that half of Red Wing's first settlers came from the New England states, driven out by declining prosperity there in search of better soil, and brought their architecture with them. Scandinavians made up the other half.
By 1854, Norwegian, Danish, Swedish communities had been established in Goodhue County, in which Red Wing is found. So this is the very beginning of my book, where I start off in Red Wing, Minnesota, which is where my great-great-grandfather settled on coming to the United States. And actually, when I went there, I was in search of what came to be known as the Round Barn. Oops, sorry about that. Leave it there. He had built a round barn, and according to the family history, it was he built it. Then I got to Red Wing and found out that it was registered under somebody else. So I had to do all this research. And I found out that he did build it, but it burnt down. And then they rebuilt it into this present look. So anyway, that was my experience there in Red Wing. Let me see, I want to make sure we have time to write. In the family history, I was telling, like I said, I was telling stories, a lot of stories. And and also going into history. So it turned out that this grandfather was in the Civil War. And so I found out that he came to America in 1856. And just about 4 years later, they asked him to fight in the Civil War. And it just seemed amazing to me that, you know, somebody would come here and then all of a sudden be drafted or, you know, have to go fight for a country that they'd only been here 4 years in. And so I included that in this little thing. Where was that story? There's a story in here somewhere. But well, anyway, I guess what I will do then is read for a few minutes from the conclusion and then let you guys write. Okay. This is the conclusion to the book. Kinfolk are a casualty of modern life. The strong ties of kin have been replaced by the corporation, the bureaucracy, the prosperity that gives us two cars and three TV sets and fast lane schedules, and the isolation of the young, the old, and the middle-aged into their respective ghettos. We no longer need each other. There are organizations for that. My mother remembers a time during the Depression when a teenage cousin, Carl, came from Minnesota to stay with her family in Bellingham, Washington. He was given a job at my grandfather's laundry, though it wasn't doing very well, a room in their house. And when my mother, also a teenager, criticized Carl for spending too much time in the bathroom, her father reprimanded her. He was kin, and he was to be treated royally. When Carl got on his feet and moved out, an aunt replaced him, and after that, another cousin. The house was never empty of kinfolk. Someone was always in between, in search of, or down on their luck, and my grandmother took them in gladly. The result was a childhood for my mother filled with stories of Minnesota's farm life and laughter. But my mother mostly remembers the laughter. It was so much more free-flowing then. Years later, when my grandmother was 95 and bedridden, my mother got a call from Elma and Henry, who were down at the Greyhound bus depot in Bellingham. She struggled to remember who Elma and Henry were. Elma said she'd heard her Aunt Feeney was ailing, and that she'd come to see her. It was late October, and they would be staying until Thanksgiving. House guests for a whole month, and my mother didn't even know them. My brother went to the depot to pick up the couple, Ma and Pa Kettle, he joked, with their farm clothes and ancient worn bags. There was no talk of plans or schedules. Kinfolk superseded those. They were here to see Aunt Feeney. They settled in immediately and made themselves at home. Henry camped in front of the TV set watching game shows. My brother hated at full volume. He was a little deaf. And Alma talked more than anyone my mother had ever met. And they ate, with their good farm appetites, keeping my mother at the stove more often than she was used to. But when they left, and my mother and brother's life was their own again, they talked about Alma and Henry, and what an experience it was. It isn't just that kinfolk have disappeared, but the need for people. I'm told that in the early days, in Minnesota and Dakota farms, if a stranger passed by, they would be welcomed with a warm bed and many meals, as many as they could, and the house would be animated by talking and laughing late into the night. Life was lonely on the farm, and neighbors were few and far between. With no TV sets to watch or cars to go in, people mattered. The stranger brought news of other communities, other towns, and of the outside world. Today, the stranger might be a psychopath, a serial killer. We're all isolated in neighborhoods according to ages and income. There are student ghettos, elderly ghettos, suburbs for middle-aged with children. We have double locks, peepholes, security systems, gates and walls. Not at Holden, though. No one gets in, and unfortunately, neither can we get out. And there's no time for a casual encounter, either, with our full schedules. We have jobs and classes, errands and trips. Always on the go, we're completely booked up. Today, we dare not visit without calling or checking someone's schedule. Sometimes it's a week before those schedules allow time for a meeting. Sometimes, never. Sometimes, even a phone call is considered an intrusion. Our lives are in the present, and private time is considered sacred. The past is respected neither in time we don't have or the space that we inhabit. Old buildings are torn down and new ones replace them. In Minnesota, I visited several Lutheran churches in the countryside where this modern madness was not known. The new church was built next to the old one, which was kept for weddings and other functions. Space is not at a premium there, and the past is revered. The churches are never locked and open to passersby to stop in and pray. To do otherwise would be a sin. In our towns and cities, where space is measured by dollars per foot and not sentiment, the old must be torn down before the new can be erected. The old is destroyed. It is too dark, too small. Its floors are slanting. It's unsafe. There would be lawsuits. Finally, it is torn down with relief, relieving the congregation of a great burden, an eyesore. Growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I noticed a similar attitude towards nature. The old growth forests, now mostly gone to sawmills, were chopped down so that new growth could replace it. Yet, the old growth, both living and dead, serves an important function in the forest, sheltering it from bright sun and sudden temperature changes, allowing an immense, diverse ecosystem of living things beneath it. The towering aged trees, more than 200 feet tall, protect and nurture the younger generations. Outside the house where I grew up, there was an old Douglas fir that finally had to be cut down. From its stump came a fir sapling, which is now 20 feet tall. We call the old stump the nursing tree. Out of the old comes the new. Cut off from our roots, we are impoverished and lacking in diversity. Everything is the same. The personality cannot develop. Who are we really? We don't like categories and stereotypes. Not wanting to be ourselves, individual, protecting our own space, our own agendas, fighting to keep out intrusions, strangers in the past. We surround ourselves with people of similar age, interests, and bank accounts. To do anything else would be threatening. I became interested in my forefathers as an adult in my mid-30s, while a graduate student in Boston. I came upon an artifact, a diary of a minister written 100 years ago, mentioning my great-great-grandfather. Like an archaeologist, I was excited. Is there more? I thought and began digging. When I found nothing vertically, I dug horizontally. So I excavated my own personal Grand Canyon. Layer upon layer, I dusted off my findings and placed them in file folders, hoping to make sense of it later. I discovered the life I knew on the surface to be only the tip of the iceberg. Beneath it lay a richness I hadn't dreamed of. The life of my ancestors was so different than mine. It was a good life. A life of connection and caring. And it was a life that could not have been possible without kinfolk. So that's my conclusion. But now...
Why?
Writing.
Why are you going to voice this on us?
Uh-huh, yeah. What I thought is, I have these ideas here, and what I'd really like to do is that you started writing something here so that we can share it with each other. And that way, you know, even if you've done writing before, you can always start something fresh, and maybe you'll be inspired up here at Holden to write something really neat. Who knows? But anyway, those are some ideas. And if you don't have paper, I have paper. And if you don't like those ideas, I'm sure you can think of others.
These are stimulating ideas, very good.
Uh-huh.
This would have been good for my creative writing class.
Well,
you better go down.
Take it home. Are you still in it? You still?
No, they have my quarters, and I've been in either two or three quarters, and,
mm-hmm.
and I may get back into it again.
Well, then.
You know, this is good.
Yeah. So, and there's tables there. Or if you prefer to write later, I suppose you could do that. But
is there, another session coming?
Yeah, there's more sessions coming. So, but I thought it'd be really neat to hear some of your stories. Because it sounds...
But I'm leaving.
You're
Wednesday
leaving.
Morning.
When?
Wednesday.
Oh, well, there's one tomorrow. You could write something in time for that.
Yeah.
Think you could? Good.
I don't know which one. Number, what was it down here? Number 8, I don't think we probably know much. Well, about the Civil War prohibition.
No, yeah. That's...
Civil War I. We weren't even involved in Civil War. Well, maybe prohibition.
Yeah, I would think there were some other wars you were probably
well. We were well. We had wars between non-Indian people.
Yeah, I guess it got pretty. I read a book. It's quite good. I don't know if it's slanted or not about some of the Nisqually Valley.
Yeah.
It's in the library there. It's called Mighty Mountain.
Yeah.
And it's written by Archie Binns, but he has a lot about that the conflicts, kind of wars
between yeah
and it's kind of very brutal and not
and I don't know if we've had like both like a day and night type of ancestry. Either that or my mother never told us about it.
Mm-hmm. You
know, because the only way our family could continue to exist is get along with each other and to keep the family unit together, because that's the only thing that kept us,
mm-hmm.
helped keep us alive,
mm-hmm.
especially when the influx of the Europeans came across. We stayed mm-hmm. together as a family unit to survive.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I know it.
Well, that's good.
More of the
well, that certainly is
that.
Better.
I don't know
I
about
mean,
black sheep. Yeah.
No.
We're all black sheep.
How about a white sheep?
Well, there were a lot of white sheep coming over. That was, coming up across the Oregon Trail.
Yeah. I don't know. So, yeah, this is probably geared more toward what I was writing about European
mm-hmm.
people, so you would have to... But that, what you said about, just substitute cooperation, and there you have your story.
Yeah.
We cooperated while those people over there were arguing.
trying to figure out in Seattle what kind of land they could, how they could figure out how to obtain the land and get the land. And, They're settling there around.
Yeah, one thing I found out, well, there's in the Norwegians, we had the founding of the Lutheran churches, and there was tremendous clashes over that. They would start a Lutheran church, and all of a sudden they'd start arguing, and then they'd say, okay, we're through with you guys, and then build another church right across the street. And then, so you have, and it really, I think it worked out for the best, because then you got so many Lutheran churches that way.
I thought they, as I understood it, they stayed more or less by their nationality.
Yeah.
The Norwegians stayed with Norwegians and Swedes.
Yeah, but even they didn't the Norwegians, they had problems.
Yeah, this is within the Norwegians.
Oh, within the Norwegians.